Welcome back, everybody, to another deep dive. This time, we're getting into urban economics and social mobility.
Oh, fun!
Using some fascinating research by economist Thomas Sowell.
Yeah, this should be interesting.
It's gonna be really a fascinating look at how cities actually work.
Yeah.
You know, from like traffic jams to housing costs and everything in between.
Right.
And it kind of like zoom out to see how all that connects to like whether people rise or fall in society.
Mm.
You know, the whole social mobility question.
Yeah, very much in the news lately. So
yeah, absolutely.
Should be good.
Yeah.
So
a lot of people are worried about that.
Yeah. So to kind of set the stage, like what's the fundamental idea that Sowell is exploring in this section of his book?
Well, he points out that cities often defy common sense.
Oh, okay.
You know, things that seem like they should work sometimes backfire spectacularly.
I gotcha. Like what?
So we're gonna be looking at some of those examples.
Give me an example.
Well, one of the classic examples is rent control.
Which, on the surface, seems like a great way to help people afford housing, right?
Sure.
But what Sowell highlights is that it can actually worsen the housing shortage.
Really?
It can make it harder for people to find affordable housing.
Wow. That's counterintuitive.
It is.
So how does that...
Yeah, and Egypt's experience with rent control in 1960 is a perfect illustration of this.
Egypt.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what happened was...
I never would have thought to look there for that example.
Yeah. Well, by setting rents below market value, the government discouraged investment in new housing construction.
Right.
Why would developers build new apartments if they can't charge a reasonable rent, right?
Right.
At the same time, existing landlords had little incentive to maintain their properties.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't increase rents to cover the costs.
So everything just kind of falls apart?
Yeah. The end result was fewer apartments available.
Makes sense.
And the ones that did exist were often run down and neglected.
So it hurts the very people it's trying to help.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, huh. It's like that saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, you think you're doing the right thing.
Right.
But then these unintended consequences.
Yeah, and they're rarely obvious at first glance.
Yeah, yeah. No kidding.
You have to really think it through.
Okay, so this reminds me of another, like, urban headache.
What's that?
Traffic.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Like, even if you don't live in a big city.
Right.
You've probably experienced, like, soul-crushing congestion at some point.
Yeah.
And it feels like, you know, no matter how many roads we build, it never gets better.
Right. And so Sowell points out that even like free roads aren't truly free.
Oh, interesting.
We pay for them in wasted time, wasted fuel, and of course, increased pollution.
Right, right.
It's a hidden cost that we often overlook.
So what's the answer then if building more roads, isn't it?
Well, there's this system called congestion pricing.
I've heard of that.
Yeah.
Like making people pay to drive?
Yeah. It involves charging drivers a fee to use the most crowded roads during peak hours.
Who wants that?
I know it sounds counterintuitive, but it's been surprisingly successful in cities like Singapore and Stockholm.
Did it really work?
Yeah. They saw a significant decrease in traffic.
Even though their
populations and the number of cars on the road continued to grow.
Get out.
Yeah. Drivers had a financial incentive to carpool, use public transportation.
Right.
Or adjust their travel times to avoid the fees.
Ah.
And because congestion decreased, everyone benefited from shorter commute times.
Wow.
Reduced pollution.
So sometimes making something more expensive can actually make it better.
Yeah, sometimes.
That's wild.
It highlights the importance of looking beyond simplistic solutions.
Right.
Understanding the complex dynamics at play.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Okay, well, speaking of complex dynamics, let's talk about urban sprawl.
Okay.
You know, it often gets demonized as this, like, environmental disaster.
Right.
But is it always a bad thing?
Well, it's important to understand what urban sprawl actually means. It's not just about people moving to the suburbs.
Okay.
It's also about jobs moving there, too.
Interest.
And this isn't a new phenomenon either.
Oh, really?
So Kiel points out that this trend was already evident in the early 20th century.
So it's not just white picket fences and manicured lawns.
Yeah.
Businesses are heading out to the suburbs, too.
Exactly.
But what about the environmental impact?
Mm-hmm.
Don't people end up driving further and polluting more?
That's a common assumption, but the data doesn't necessarily support it.
Really?
Yeah. In many cases, people's commutes haven't actually gotten longer with suburbanization.
Mm.
And in some instances, they might even be shorter than they were before.
Wow. So the classic image of like endless suburbs sprawling outwards and forcing everyone into these long car commutes
right.
might be a little bit of an exaggeration.
It seems that way.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, it's important to examine the nuances of these issues
right.
rather than relying on simplistic narratives.
Gotcha. Okay.
For example, think about those open space policies that are designed to combat sprawl.
Sure.
On the surface, they sound great.
Yeah, who doesn't love parks?
Who doesn't want more parks and green spaces?
Exactly.
But they can have some unintended consequences as well.
Oh, like what?
Well, one maybe issue is that they can end up driving up housing costs.
Really?
Which effectively excludes people of modest means.
Sure.
So, you know, in a way, they contribute to creating these exclusive enclaves for the wealthy.
Oh, interesting.
Which further exacerbates social divisions.
So it's not really about, like, quote unquote, saving the environment.
Right.
As much as it is about, like, who gets to live in these desirable areas.
It's a complex issue with both positive and negative aspects.
Right.
It highlights the need for a nuanced understanding of the trade-offs involved.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
But, you know, that raises another crucial question.
What's that?
If we're pricing people out of certain areas, are we really creating a level playing field?
That's a great point. And the perfect segue to the second part of our deep dive.
For shoes.
Social mobility.
Yeah.
You know, we often hear about the American dream.
Right.
This idea that anyone can climb the economic ladder
mm-hmm.
with hard work and determination.
Yep.
But is that really true?
That's a big question.
Do we all have the same chances in life?
And so Well doesn't shy away from tackling it.
What does he say?
He argues that assuming everyone has the same chances is actually a huge fallacy.
Interesting. I'm already sensing this is going to be a myth-busting conversation.
Yeah.
So what's a specific example?
Well, let's talk about income statistics.
Okay.
You often hear the alarming statistic that household income in the U.S. only rose 6% from 1969 to 1996.
Yeah, that's a pretty dismal figure.
Right. It makes it sound like a lot of people were stuck in a rut.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. The statistic is incredibly misleading.
How so?
It doesn't take into account changes in household size.
Wait, how does household size matter?
It matters a lot. The average household was actually shrinking during that time period.
Oh, interesting.
Think about it. More single-person households, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Would naturally lead to lower average household income.
Oh, I see.
So it's not that people weren't making more money. It's just that households were getting smaller.
Gotcha. So it skews the numbers.
Exactly. And when you look at per capita income, that is income per person, the picture changes drastically.
Okay.
During that same time period, per capita income actually jumped 51%.
Whoa. That's a huge difference.
That's a huge difference.
I can't believe that that misleading statistic about household income gets repeated so often.
It just goes to show how important it is to dig deeper.
Yeah.
Look at the whole picture.
Absolutely. I'm with you on that.
Especially when it comes to economic data.
So if the story about stagnant household income is a myth,
yeah.
What about the often repeated claim that the middle class is vanishing?
That's another myth that needs to be debunked.
Okay.
The middle class isn't disappearing. It's actually moving up the income ladder.
Okay.
Imagine you have a ladder and everyone starts climbing.
Mm-hmm.
There will naturally be fewer people on the middle rungs.
Right.
But that doesn't mean they've vanished.
Right.
They're just higher up.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah, it's so simple.
It perfectly illustrates the point.
Yeah, it's just a matter of perspective.
So we need to be careful about how we interpret these economic indicators.
Right.
Especially when they're being used to paint a gloomy picture of society.
Absolutely. There's often more to the story than meets the eye.
Okay, so we've busted a couple of myths about income in the middle class.
Right.
But let's get back to social mobility.
Okay.
You mentioned that culture plays a big role in people's life chances.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's not just about external factors like discrimination or poverty.
Okay.
The culture people are exposed to, the values, beliefs, and habits that are instilled in them from a young age mm-hmm. has a huge impact on their future success.
Okay. Give me a concrete example.
Well, studies have shown that even when you control for things like income and education, Black children are more likely to have problems in school if they come from homes that lack certain things.
Okay, so like what kinds of things are we talking about?
Things like newspapers, magazines, or even library cards.
Really?
These may seem like small things, but they're indicators of a home environment where learning is valued and encouraged.
Oh. Okay.
Kids from these homes are more likely to develop the knowledge base and intellectual curiosity that will benefit them later in life.
So it's not just about how much money you have.
Right.
It's also about the values and attitudes you're exposed to growing up.
Exactly.
And that's why it's so important to understand these cultural differences.
Right.
If we really want to help people improve their lives.
It's not about blame.
Right.
It's about recognizing the power of these influences.
This is all really eye-opening.
Good.
I'm starting to see the world through a different lens.
That's what we're here for.
I'm eager to continue this conversation and learn more about what Sawell has to say.
Sounds good. It's not about blame. It's about recognizing the power of these influences.
And it sounds like Sawell is pushing back against this tendency to just blame, like, quote-unquote, society.
Yeah.
For everything.
Right.
He's saying we need to look deeper and acknowledge the role of, like, individual choices and cultural values.
Exactly. And that brings us to another crucial point. Sawell makes the importance of understanding incentives.
Okay. I'm intrigued. How do incentives fit into all of this?
It sounds a little dry, but yeah. I think we can make it interesting.
I trust you.
Think of it this way. Incentives are like invisible forces that shape our behavior.
Okay.
If you want to encourage a particular behavior, you need to create incentives that make that behavior more appealing.
Sure.
On the flip side, if you want to discourage something, you create disincentives that make it less attractive.
Okay, that makes sense. But how does this apply to something as complex as social mobility?
In countless ways. Take welfare programs, for example.
Okay.
They're designed to help people in need, which is a noble goal.
Sure.
But Sawell points out that if these programs aren't carefully designed, they can unintentionally create disincentives to work.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Right.
If someone can receive more benefits by not working than by working,
right,
it might make them less inclined to seek employment.
Exactly.
You know, why work when you can get paid to stay home?
Right. And it's not about judging anyone's choices.
Yeah.
It's about understanding how people respond to incentives.
Right.
So the challenge for policymakers is to find that sweet spot, a balance between providing a safety net for those who truly need it.
Right.
While also encouraging self-sufficiency and a desire to work.
So it's not just about throwing money at problems, but about creating a system that actually helps people become independent and improve their lives in a sustainable way.
Exactly.
Seems like a delicate balancing act.
It is. And this is just one example of how incentives play a role in social mobility.
Right.
Think about education. Okay.
If students aren't incentivized to learn and achieve, they're less likely to put in the effort needed to succeed.
Makes sense.
Or consider entrepreneurship.
Okay.
If the risks outweigh the potential rewards, people will be less likely to start businesses.
Right.
Which ultimately stifles innovation and economic growth.
Wow. I'm starting to see how incentives are like woven into the very fabric of our society and how they can either propel people forward or hold them back.
It's like an invisible hand guiding our actions.
Yeah. This is definitely making me think differently about the world.
Good.
And it's important to remember that these incentives aren't always financial.
Right.
Right? They can be social, emotional, or even cultural.
Exactly.
That's a great point. We're not just talking about dollars and cents here. Mm-hmm. It's about the whole range of motivations that drive human behavior.
Right.
But I have to admit, sometimes it feels like certain groups face more obstacles than others, no matter how hard they try.
Yeah.
Is it really possible to overcome those systemic barriers? That's a tough question.
Yeah.
And it brings us to another fascinating insight from Sowell's work, the fallacy of assuming that all differences in outcomes are due to discrimination.
Okay, let's dive into that. It's a sensitive topic, but a crucial one to discuss, especially if we want to understand social mobility.
Absolutely. Now, it's undeniable that discrimination exists.
Sure.
And that it can have a devastating impact on individuals and entire communities.
Of course.
But to assume that all disparities between groups are solely due to discrimination is a dangerous oversimplification.
So what are some of the other factors that might contribute to these differences in outcomes?
Well, we've already discussed culture,
right?
And that's a huge one.
Yeah.
But there are also things like age, experience, education, risk tolerance, and even personal choices.
Right.
All of these things can influence a person's trajectory in life.
Can you give me a specific example?
Sure. Think about the gender pay gap,
right,
which is often cited as evidence of discrimination against women. Yeah. While that's certainly part of the equation, it's not the whole story.
Right.
Often when people talk about the pay gap, they're making gross comparisons between men's and women's earnings.
Right.
Without considering other factors.
What kind of factors are we talking about?
Things like the types of careers people choose, the number of hours they work, the years of experience they have, or whether they've taken time off for family responsibilities.
Right. All things that could legitimately impact someone's income.
Exactly.
Regardless of gender.
All of these things can significantly affect earnings.
So you're saying that if you compare men and women who have made similar choices in terms of their careers, their work hours, and their family responsibilities.
Yeah, right.
The pay gap shrinks.
That's exactly what many studies have shown. In fact, some research has even found that for certain age groups and occupations, women actually earn more than men.
Wow, that's really surprising. I think a lot of people would be shocked to hear that.
It definitely challenges the conventional wisdom.
It does.
And that's why it's so important to be skeptical of simplistic explanations.
You're right.
And to dig deeper into the data.
Yeah.
We can't just jump to conclusions about discrimination without considering all of the other factors that might be at play.
It sounds like what you're advocating for is a more nuanced and holistic approach to these issues.
Exactly.
We can't just look at one piece of the puzzle and assume we have the whole picture.
Precisely. And that's true not just for gender, but for race, ethnicity, and other group comparisons.
Sure.
It's essential to approach these issues with a critical eye and a willingness to consider multiple perspectives.
So if we can't just blame, quote unquote, society for everything, how do we start to untangle these complex problems and find solutions that actually work?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It feels like we've identified a lot of challenges, but what are the potential paths forward?
It means we need to move beyond simplistic solutions and embrace a more nuanced understanding of the challenges we face.
Okay, I'm with you on that. But what does that look like in practice? Mm-hmm. How do we translate this nuanced understanding into concrete action?
It means focusing on policies that empower individuals, promote personal responsibility,
right,
and create the right incentives for success.
Got it.
It means recognizing that one-size-fits-all solutions rarely work.
Right.
And that we need to tailor our approaches to the specific needs of different individuals and communities.
So we need to move away from like blanket policies and embrace a more personalized approach.
Yeah.
That sounds challenging, but also very promising.
It is.
But what about those who are truly disadvantaged?
Mm.
Those who face systemic barriers that are beyond their control?
Mm.
How do we help them?
Of course, we can't ignore those who are facing real obstacles.
Right.
We absolutely need a safety net in place for those who are truly in need.
Sure.
But even then, our goal should be to empower people to become self-sufficient.
Right.
Not to create a system of perpetual dependence.
It's about finding that balance between compassion and empowerment, right?
Yeah.
Providing support without fostering a sense of helplessness.
Exactly. And it's about recognizing that there is no one-size-fits-all solution.
Right.
What works for one person may not work for another.
Right.
We need to be flexible and adaptable in our approach.
This whole conversation is making me realize how much more I have to learn.
Good. That's a good sign.
It's like you've peeled back layers of complexity that I never even knew existed.
It's about continually questioning our assumptions and being open to new perspectives.
Yeah.
And remember, even experts don't have all the answers.
Right.
It's an ongoing process of learning and discovery.
Well said.
Yeah.
I think our listeners are going to walk away from this deep dive with a lot to think about.
Hopefully.
And maybe even a little bit of intellectual whiplash.
That's all right. A little bit of, that's good.
But in a good way, of course.
Right.
I know I'm feeling that way right now.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
To challenge our thinking and expand our understanding of the world.
I'm excited to see where this new perspective takes us. But before we wrap up, is there anything else from Saul's research that you think is particularly relevant to our listeners?
There's one more area I'd like to touch on that I think is particularly relevant today, and that's Sowell's work on third world countries.
Oh, okay.
And the challenges they face in achieving economic development.
So we've been talking about cities and social mobility within a country, but now we're kind of like zooming out to look at the global picture.
Exactly.
So what are some of the common misconceptions about why some countries are rich and others struggle to escape poverty?
Well, one of the most persistent myths is that wealthy nations got that way by exploiting poorer ones.
Oh, okay.
It's a narrative that often ignores the complex historical and economic factors at play.
So if exploitation isn't the primary driver of global inequality, what is?
Mm-hmm.
Is it just about like natural resources?
Well, it's part of it.
Okay.
But it's not the whole story.
Do some countries just have more luck than others?
Well, Sowell identifies several key factors that contribute to economic success or failure. And geography is a big one.
Oh, interesting.
Countries that are landlocked or lack access to major waterways tend to have a harder time developing their economies.
Right, because it limits trade.
Exactly. They're often limited in their ability to trade, which hinders their access to global markets and technologies.
It's like being stuck in a corner of the board game.
Right.
While other players have like easier routes to resources and trade opportunities.
That's a good analogy.
So geography kind of deals you a certain hand.
Mm.
But what you do with those cards still matters.
Exactly. And that's where factors like history, culture, and government policies come into play.
Okay.
History undeniably plays a role.
Sure.
Colonialism, slavery, and other forms of oppression have left lasting scars on many nations.
Of course.
But Sowell argues that we can't just blame the past for all of today's problems.
Right.
We need to look at the choices countries are making in the present.
It's about taking responsibility for your own destiny, even if you've been dealt a difficult hand. So what are some of the things that successful countries have done differently?
Well, there's a clear pattern.
Okay.
Countries that have embraced free markets, protected property rights, and established a stable legal system tend to see significantly more economic progress than those that haven't.
That sounds familiar.
Right.
We talked about the importance of incentives earlier, and it seems like that principle applies on a global scale as well.
Absolutely.
You know, if people know their property is secure and that they can reap the rewards of their hard work,
Right.
they're more likely to invest, innovate, and create wealth.
Precisely. It's about creating an environment where individuals are empowered to succeed.
Okay.
Foreign aid can sometimes be helpful in the short term,
Sure.
but it's not a long-term solution.
Okay.
The real key to sustainable development is fostering self-reliance
Gotcha.
and creating systems that encourage people to help themselves.
So it's not about handouts.
Right.
It's about building a foundation for lasting prosperity. It sounds like Sowell's insights are relevant, not just for policymakers, but for individuals as well.
Definitely.
Yeah, what can our listener take away from all of this?
I think the biggest takeaway is that we all have a role to play in creating a more just and prosperous world.
Okay.
We can start by challenging our own assumptions, being open to new perspectives,
Yeah.
and recognizing that simple solutions rarely address complex problems.
That's a powerful message. We've covered so much ground today,
We have.
from the inner workings of cities to the global dynamics of wealth and
It's
poverty.
all connected.
I feel like I've gained a whole new understanding of how these seemingly disparate issues are interconnected.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
And I'm walking away with a renewed sense of hope
Excellent.
and a desire to make a difference, even if it's just in my own small corner of the world.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah,
Taking
absolutely.
that knowledge and using it to create positive change.
I couldn't agree more. And I think Sowell's work gives us a framework for thinking about these challenges in a more realistic and productive way.
I agree.
You know, it's not about easy answers, but about a commitment to understanding, to action, and to the belief that a better future is possible.
Well said.
And on that note, we'll wrap up this incredible deep dive. Thank you so much for joining us on this journey of discovery. Remember, keep questioning, keep learning, and keep striving to make a difference. Until next time.
Thanks for having me.